Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode, we are speaking with Chief Science Officer at Unlearn AI, Dave Miller.
Dave is a biostatistician with nearly 30 years of expertise in prognostic models, clinical trials, observational studies, and diagnostic devices. And he has spent nearly 2 years with his current company, Unlearn AI, and prior to being named the Chief Science Officer at the start of this year, he served as Head of Biostatistics. Dave has also spent time with Verily Life Sciences, Genomic Health, and ICON. So thank you for joining us today, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. So the first question I wanted to get into is that, you know, we've been hearing at ACT increased attention on digital twins use in clinical trials. So can you explain to our audience of ClinOps professionals exactly how a digital twin works?
Sure. And I should start by saying we've been using more and more recently the term prognostic digital twins. I think that the concept of digital twins has captured the public's imagination in a lot of different spaces. And so it's getting used in a lot of different ways. But what our models produce are prognostic digital twins. And these are rich predictions of what we would expect a patient to have as their outcomes and multiple outcomes. We're not just predicting a single outcome, but all of the outcomes that are traditionally studied in clinical trials in a given disease area, if they were in the control group. And the prognostic digital twins are created both for patients who are in the treatment group and for patients who are in the control group. So in the control group, it's a prediction of what's actually going to happen with that patient. And in the treated group, it's a prediction of what would happen with that patient had they not been treated. And that information allows us to do smaller trials, and smaller trials are, of course, faster trials. And it also allows us to change the randomization ratio so that you can have fewer patients randomized to control in a study, which, you know, makes it a more patient-centric design.
So, Dave, just following up on that, could you explain it a little bit more from the ClinOps perspective, how the digital twins work?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're doing the clinical trial and you've collected the baseline data for patients, the baseline data is the only data that we need to create the prognostic digital twins. And in fact, we would be adding bias to the study if we were using anything other than the baseline data. And so what that means is that once the baseline data has been collected, it can be sent to us and we'll use our digital twin generators to create the prognostic digital twins, and then we can send them back. And so you can sort of think of us as one additional data source, one additional data stream that's in the study, but it should be very seamless working with the clinical data management group to receive the baseline data and then to send back this additional piece of information on every patient that's the prognostic digital twins.
So in what types of trials do you see these prognostic digital twins most beneficial?
Well, I think that they're most beneficial, and where we see the most market demand is trials that are long, difficult to enroll. Now, I think I need to caveat that by saying that some of the most difficult to enroll trials are very, very rare diseases. And for very, very rare diseases, it's more difficult for us to develop a really good AI model. We can develop a model, but the diseases that are rare enough or challenging enough for enrollment, but not so rare that it's hard to build a model or kind of the sweet spot. Having said that, we intend to build models for every disease eventually. But in terms of getting early adoption and getting people comfortable with the technology, the diseases where we have the most benefit, meaning that you can speed enrollment in the biggest way, are the best diseases.
Thank you, Dave. So the next question I have, this is kind of a two-parter here. Are digital twins considered to be digital medicine? And then are they regulated by FDA?
Yeah, great questions. So I would not consider it to be digital medicine, and I wouldn't consider it to be medicine. We'd be in a completely different regulatory category if we were using these digital twins in the practice of medicine. I think, you know, long-term, 10, 20 years out, there may be applications like that, but where we've really begun our focus is working in the clinical trial space. And in the clinical trial space, in terms of regulations, this is really a methodology that can be put into a clinical trial. And so it's becomes part and parcel of the clinical trial design. So from that standpoint, it's not precisely regulated by FDA or EMA for that matter, but you can get a method qualified by, for instance, EMA. So we've just recently had one of our trial designs qualified by EMA, and EMA has made a clear statement based on our application that you can use our method to reduce sample size without creating bias.
What hesitancies does pharma have around digital twin that you're sensing? And what do you think it will take to alleviate any concerns if there are some?
Yeah, and I mean, I should clarify a little bit more the point about regulation. So FDA, EMA, they are going to accept or not accept data from a particular trial with a particular trial design. And so if you put some new technology like this into a trial and it's not acceptable to regulators, then that's a huge problem. And that's why we were really proactive in going out and getting the EMA qualification. With FDA, they don't have a qualification process that's comparable to the EMA qualification process. And so we'll have to go to FDA with individual protocols and have them agree that ideally that what we're doing is very well aligned with the covariate adjustment guidance that they put out in May of last year. So we feel like we've paid special attention to existing regulations in developing our methodology. But the regulatory path is certainly one of the things that every single potential partner raises with us is how can you be absolutely sure that FDA will accept this? That's one of the hesitancies. I think it shouldn't be a hesitancy, but it is one of the hesitancies. I think the other hesitancy is that, you know, what we're saying is we can help you do a smaller study with fewer control patients without adding any bias. And when people hear that, it sounds too good to be true. I think that people also have a tendency, because we're using historical data, to think that we're doing something with real world evidence or real world data. We're not. Most of our models are built from randomized trial data, from historical randomized trial data, but it's not real world data, it's trial data. And we're putting it into a randomized trial. So it's really not real world evidence either. It is fundamentally a randomized clinical trial that's just getting a boost from this added technology.
As a chief science officer and someone who has worked in research, like we mentioned earlier, what do you see as the most exciting developments around clinical trials?
So I think partly because of the pandemic, pharma was forced to innovate a little bit more than what is sort of naturally in the pharma DNA as far as innovation goes. And so there were some developments, for instance, in Bayesian trials, in adaptive design. I think that those are two really important developments. And PDUFA 7, the one that was just passed by Congress in September of this year, has explicit language that FDA needs to develop a guidance around using Bayesian trial designs for CDER and CBER. There's already some acceptance of Bayesian designs at CDRH, but CDER and CBER have been a little bit slower on that. The pandemic pushed them. And I did my statistics education at Carnegie Mellon, which was a very Bayesian program in the 80s. And I've been waiting, 30 years for Bayesian methods to develop some acceptability. And I think it's really finally happening. So I'm very excited about that.
That's an interesting point, because we do hear a lot about Bayesian. I mean, I've read that over the years in our publication, and to know that it's 30 years in the making, very interesting.
I think it's one of those things that you've been hearing about, that it's just around the corner. And yeah. I think there's been a lot of false advertising about that, because I do think that academics have been fairly distant from actual clinical trial practice with some of those methods. But now, I really do believe, partly because of its inclusion in PDUFA 7, that it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's kind of like AI, really. We've been hearing about AI for a while, but now it really seems to be more accepted and maybe still in its infancy. I'm not sure. How would you characterize it?
I think that it's still in its infancy in medicine. I think that this actually leads me into a little bit different topic with the prognostic digital twins. So our prognostic digital twins are predictions, and they're not perfect predictions. And what we've done with the methodology that we call a twin RCT, the twin RCT is acknowledging that they're not perfect predictions, And it's putting it into the trial in a way where we're not adding any bias in spite of the fact that they're not perfect predictions. I think that the way that AI has gone wrong in medicine in the last decade or so is thinking that the predictions were better than they really are. And if you think your prediction is better than it is, then you can really make some bad decisions. But if you're not just making a prediction, but you're also accurately estimating approximately how precise your prediction is, then you can do something that's meaningful, that's adding to what the original framework is with the AI, and you're putting the AI together with the traditional methods to have something that really is robust.
Thank you so much, Dave, for those explanations, because you really bring it down to a point where we can truly understand it. And I'm sure our audience will be grateful for that also. So thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you, Dave.